Welcome to Table Talk, a place for honest conversations and getting to meet friends. Y'all, today's a very special episode. We are here with Tina Farrell. Thank you so much for coming and hanging out today. I have to tell you, I have heard of you for years, a long time, and finally got to meet you just this last spring. Immediately was like, well, this is a ray of sunshine. So fun. And I was thinking, I was like, there's so many things we could talk about because one, your career and what you've done. Right. Are you still at U of H Clear Lake? Are you retired?
I retired as the assistant superintendent for Clear Creek Independent School District.
Okay. See, some of y'all might know her from Clear Creek. Yes.
Yes. And then I immediately started teaching at the University of Houston, Clear Lake.
Okay.
So I'm still there. I'm part-time.
Okay. Y'all. So we could talk about that. Like, just all of that you've done is so fun. But you wrote a book about your dad.
I did.
Do you call him dad or daddy?
I call him daddy.
Okay, because I was going to say, my mom always called her dad daddy, too. Yeah. And I think that was very much, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people still do, but I think that generation was very much, that's daddy.
That's correct.
That's who that is. That's correct. And you wrote this amazing book about him called 868. Yes. And we're going to dig into it, and that's why she's here today. And I'm so, y'all, there's so much we could talk about. We're going to try to keep it on track so we can do the thing. But it's so cool. So first of all, before we even jump into this, just tell everybody a little bit more about maybe even just how you ended up at Sagemont. And just a little bit. So if they're like, she kind of looks familiar, tell us a little bit about what you do here, too.
Oh, great. My husband and I came to Sagemont Church in 1987, brought our daughter here. She grew up through the church, went through the youth program, graduated through the church.
That's
awesome. So we've been here since 1987, and we've been in, we worked under Emory Gad. We were counselors for a while, youth camp, that kind of thing. And then I've been in Vacation Bible School. But most recently, I've been serving in Helping Hands.
Yes, I love that.
Which I adore. I love that that ministry, and I love working with that ministry. And so that's what I've been doing. And my husband is on the parking lot ministry.
Awesome. We love those guys so much. Especially with how busy it's gotten.
Yes.
They're having to like...
They're hustling to get people
in and out of this parking lot. They're earning their crowns, as Pastor Levi's told us, that they're going to get to throw at the feet of Jesus.
Yes, they are.
They are doing it. That's so awesome. Yes. Okay, so I love that. Tell me just first, why a book? What made you decide this story? Because we're going to get into the story, but even the... Why take this story that you knew and put it into a book? Because books aren't easy.
They're not.
They're not easy.
They're not. They're really not easy. I felt a real pulling of the Holy Spirit, a real call to tell his story. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, part of being a POW and a soldier at war, a combat soldier, they typically do not talk about their experiences.
Right.
So you don't get to know them. And he had... four girls in his home, my mother and three daughters, and so he certainly didn't talk much about that. But over time, as he got older, he began to tell me stories and tell my sister stories, and we'd hear a little bit and a little bit, and then he would tell me something that I certainly recognized as a miracle, and I'd say, Daddy, how did you do that? How did you survive that? Well, good Lord, that's how I survived it. And I'm like, okay. So I started, every time he would talk, I started writing on napkins or...
No way.
Yes, a piece of paper or, you know, I couldn't even get my phone out because I didn't want him to know, to know. So I'm like writing. And so I just took a lot of anecdotal notes. And over time, I said, this story has got to be told. This is a story of such strength and such protection of our mighty God that it's got to be told. It
Absolutely.
Has to be.
That's amazing. Okay, so let's dig into this.
Okay.
Talk a little bit about where did he grow up? Okay. And one thing I think that's interesting is, because you said this just a second ago, I thought it was so good. You said, so often when people are in really, really difficult places, they'll pray to God and not even know who they're praying to. But they get to the point where they're like, God, if somebody is out there.
That's correct.
And you said your dad was like, no, he knew.
Yeah.
He knew
who
he was praying to when he got to that place.
Oh, yeah.
So talk a little bit about even his upbringing.
Okay.
And how did... how did he come to know the Lord and have that kind of faith at a young age? I mean, he was 21 going into the military and stuff. So tell us a little bit about him.
Okay. Well, he was a sharecropper's son, which is part of the reason why the title has a sharecropper's son. He grew up in Glen Rose, Texas. He was born and raised there. He went to school until he was in sixth grade. He had to stop because he had to take care of his family, and he had to work on the, you know, in the farm and do sharecropping. And so he grew up there. His mother, my grandmother, unbelievably faithful Christian. My grandfather was an unbelievably faithful Christian, but he was such a hard worker. He taught him about the land and about plants that can heal you. He taught him about putting charcoal and on a tree branch and brushing your teeth so you can save your teeth. And so he learned medicinal types of things from my grandfather. He learned in the world of faith from my grandmother, and he had memorized many scriptures by the time he was probably about 11 years old. But he was saved and baptized in the Paluxy River.
Oh, how fun!
In Glen Rose when he was a little boy. And so he had been saved at a very early time in his life and had a very strong faith as a result of it.
Wow, I love that. And so then he gets into late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
And during that time, Great Depression is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, talk a little about where he first went to work because of the Great Depression and how he ended up in what is now the Air Force.
Okay. Well, his father died of, it was a terrible farming kind of accident. It was just a heat wave that had passed through. My dad was 18. And his father died of a heat stroke out on the farm. And so he immediately had to become the man of the house. He had to take care of his mother and his sisters. And so he did all kinds of bartering and jobs and trading and whatever he needed to do. But he realized he needed something much more sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so he joined the Civilian Conservation Corps because he knew he could send money back. And at that time, it was $30 a month. And you were only allowed to keep five. And so the $25 went back to your family.
You had to.
You had to.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so the $25 went back to his mother, which was a lot of money, you know, for a month when you don't really have anything.
Right.
And so he joined them, and he worked for the Civilian Conservation Corps as a cook. He became a mess hall chef, cook. And then after that, that began to wrap down. You know, the country was finished with that. We'd gotten some infrastructure built. We'd given good jobs to young men. And so his commanding officer came over to him and said, hey, you know, this is about to come to a close, and you're a hard worker. And he said, I want to make sure that you're going to be okay. And he said, so you might want to think about what your next steps are. And he was in San Antonio, Texas. And so he said, I'm going to join the military. And so he went to Fort Sam Houston and signed up that day and wanted to be a part of the Army Air Corps, and he specifically requested to be sent to work with General MacArthur. That's where he wanted to serve. He wanted to serve under him. He had a great respect for him.
So that, at what, 21?
Yeah.
To the Philippines?
Correct.
Okay.
So he was stationed in the Philippines immediately and shipped out. And they took him to the Philippines. They really didn't even have boot camp. They took him.
Isn't that interesting?
And boot camp was on the Philippines.
You were doing it.
Yeah, on-the-job boot camp. And so he went to the Philippines. He was on Corregidor Island, and he served there with General MacArthur. And General Wainwright was actually his immediate superior officer, and he became a cook there. And so he served and fed all the men and women that were on Corregidor Island with him.
Wow. And how long was he there before Pearl Harbor happened?
I think it was about 6 months into the time they were there, and they're preparing what they need to do for the military to maintain that base. That was a very important strategic place to have. Corregidor Island was because of the naval opportunities. And so I think it was about 6 months Pearl Harbor was bombed. And when that happened, obviously the news spread very, very quickly. It's not very far in the Pacific, and it came to them, and they started preparing for a full all-out assault, which is what happened.
Which is what came.
It's what came.
So that happened, that all-out assault, and talk to us about how he was captured.
Okay. So there, the bombing went on for many, many, many months, and continual. They were already losing rations, losing food, you know, that sort of thing. But they were doing everything they could do to hold Corregidor Island and make sure it was going to be okay. But eventually, you know, it was strategically taken over by the Japanese Imperial Army. And, you know, they came through boots on the ground and started just walking down those halls of that, you know, underneath in the hospital and finding them. And so they captured, I think it was about 1,600 men and women were captured. There on that part of Corregidor. And so anyway, they captured him, and he was 23 years old.
Wow. I want to show y'all. This is the picture she has of him that the Japanese took.
That's correct.
Of him. And I know y'all might not be able to see this really well, but it's one of those, I was like, it's wild to me that the Japanese were keeping track.
Yes, they did.
Keeping track.
They did.
What a handsome young man.
Yes, he was a very handsome young man.
Love it. So amazing. So amazing. And so how long was he a prisoner of war?
Once he was captured, they moved them. They moved the troops quite a bit. And so he was in about...
Was that just so they wouldn't be found?
Wouldn't be
they
found.
They were trying to keep them not where people would be able to come get mm-hmm. them.
And they strategically were moving them for different reasons. Naval yards in Japan, you know, they moved them so they could work on their own naval ships. Slave labor for wow. Their naval ships or wherever. And so he marched with a group out of Manila. And he was taken to his original prison camp was called Cabanatuan, and he was there in the Philippines. But his total captivity was 40 months. So he was captured the majority of the war until the war ended.
So this is me doing math in my head because I like math. But I'm like, okay, 40 months.
40 months.
How many years is that?
Almost
months,
4.
You go, oh, that's, I mean, not that 40 months right. is, but when you go, yeah. that's like 4 years.
Yes, it is. It is.
I mean, yeah. So from 23 to what, 27?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And it was, you know, it was brutal. It's a brutal story. You know, that was the hardest part of writing this book, yeah. this story. I wept a lot. I did. I may weep now. I wept a lot. But God wanted this story to be told, and he harnessed me up and girded me up to help me write it, because it is one of those stories that you have to look back on. There's no way he should have survived. He should not have survived. And there are about maybe 25 recorded miracles in that book, that there's no way that this should have happened. Right. He shouldn't have survived. Mm-hmm. And they're brutal and they're tough, but they lived, what he lived off of, just so you'll know, he lived off maybe a little dirty cup of rice, and they scooped the rice up off of the processing plant floors. It was not, you know, fresh rice. Mm-hmm. And a raw fish head a day. And the water was very polluted, but they didn't have fresh drinking water. But, you know, he survived off of it because he prayed over it. He prayed about it. And he remained very, very faithful in a time where I think a lot of people would have just given up. And a lot of people did.
Absolutely.
A lot of people did.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just mind-blowing that to live through that.
Yeah.
And one, just to live through that.
Correct.
But then to come back
yeah.
and live.
Yes.
And live a life.
And live a great life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the choices that he had to make,
mm-hmm.
because that doesn't just happen.
No.
He chose that.
He did.
Knowing your daddy as long
mm-hmm.
as you did,
mm-hmm.
Why do you think he did? Why did he choose that?
I am certain that it was not only because of God's ability to use him as, you know, a witness to what miracles can happen in your mm-hmm. life and that you can overcome things, but he shared with us one time that when you go through that type of cruelty and you've seen humanity at its absolute worst, and when people are beating you and starving you, and abusing you, what you want to do is you want to come back and get a better life. And he wanted to have a better life. And so he came back, and within 5 months met my mother and found my mother.
Wow.
And married and started a family as wow. soon as he could, because he just wanted a normal life. He wanted a safe home and a place where he could protect his family.
Right. And there had to be a sense of, oh my gosh, I made it through that.
Oh yeah.
You know, the Lord carried me through. There's a reason.
That's correct.
There's a reason. He has something planned for me.
Yes.
Because I can't imagine the number of friends he lost in those years.
He lost many.
Yes.
Many, 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 many. And it's not just a matter of I made it, but it's also there's an enormous amount of survivor guilt. Unbelievable survivor guilt of the people that fell before him and around him, and people that he tried to help. And there was a gentleman that we didn't find out until many years later who was in prison camp with my father, and he was literally on his deathbed. He was dying, and you could not help another prisoner. In wherever they were or whatever they were going through, you couldn't help them. And without penalty of death, and he was literally starving. And so my father, in the food line, he put a bunch of rice in the roof of his mouth, and he fed him like
a
bird.
My gosh.
Back in the camp with penalty of death, he still did it.
Wow.
And he ended up being one of our neighbors. And
no
I did
way.
Not. Yeah, I did not know that until many, many, many years later that he was with Dad.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. It's totally amazing.
That's just the whole, all of it is so amazing. The other thing I want you to talk a little bit about is this book.
Okay.
Right there.
Yeah.
Because this is wild to me.
It is.
And again, I think a huge miracle that you have that.
It is.
Talk a little bit about just, and the fact that your dad even thought to do this.
I know.
Is just really cool. Tell us what that is.
So this is a diary that my father wrote while he was in prison camp. But I am fairly certain this was begun when he was in the CCCs, because he was a mess hall cook. Mm-hmm. And so he started writing the recipes in this book. That's how it got started. Somehow or another, he managed to not have it taken from him when they first captured him.
Uh-huh.
So it's very small. It was a little leather-bound little book. And so he wrote recipes, and that's how he helped his mind at night when things were scary and he was frightened and, things were not looking really good. He wrote recipes. But he also wrote a poem in here. He wrote some notations when something would happen in the military. He would see something different, like the guards were acting differently. The actual accounting of when the bomb was dropped is in this book, because he wrote about what had happened post-bomb dropping, that what happened was the guards just disappeared overnight. And they were in the middle of these jungles. He happened to be at that time in Japan. So he was moved. And I think that's a really important part of the story is that, remember, I was telling you they marched them, but they also shipped them.
Wow.
And he is a hellship survivor, and a lot of people don't really even know what a hellship is.
Right,
but
yeah.
It's a Japanese container ship, basically. It's a cargo ship. It was never intended for anybody to live on it or be sailing in it. And they shoved like 1,600 men in the bottom of the hull of that ship, and with very little food or water and no light. And they slammed into the China Sea, and they moved them from the Philippines. This is the last year of the war, to Japan. And so he was on Shikoku Island in Japan, and he was working in the naval yards there. But the survival of the hell ship is a miracle. I mean, it's a miracle. It was a horrendous, horrendous thing that happened, and he survived that as well. And so then he was in Japan as his final year working there, and then when the bomb dropped, then the guards left them. I mean, they were told to go and leave them, and we didn't know where they were. The American military didn't know where they were, and so they had to just start dropping rations down in these jungles to see if they could find them. And so he is what is known as an atomic soldier. So he was covered in the radioactive dust from the bombs. He and all of the people that survived, And so he had cancer his entire life.
Really?
Oh, his whole life.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. He had bladder cancer, lost his bladder in like 1972. He was like the longest living ileostomy patient.
I was going to say he was, what, 97 or 98
yeah.
when he passed away?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he was 99. Yeah.
99.
A couple of days short of 99. But,
Golly.
Yeah. Yeah. He was something else. He was covered in a lot of squamous cell, you know, basal cell cancer on his arms, on his face, on his neck. And it was a constant battle his whole life. He had to have it treated. But but he survived it, you know. And he would always tell us, you know, his comments to us all the time was, he called me Booger, by the way. That was my nickname.
Fun.
Booger. And he said, Booger, he said, you just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other. That's what he would say. Trust in the Lord. Put one foot in front of the other.
I love that.
And so that's what we did.
That's amazing. Beautiful, beautiful wisdom. So tell us a little bit about how he made it home. And how did he make it home with his things?
Yes, and the pictures and his dog tags and his mess kit, you know, all of those things. Because, well, they allowed him to keep their mess kits because obviously they needed them for, you know, utilitary reasons. They needed to feed them out of them. And so they kept those. But he hid the diary up in the bamboo in the top of the Nipah hut where they lived, or in the floorboards. And so he hid that. And the photograph, I'm not certain. We never really were able to discuss it. The photograph, I'm not sure that they were issued that. I'm not sure. But it was in the diary.
Okay.
And so... but because they were left, you know, and everyone was gone, whatever they had in their possession, they were able to bring home.
They were taken with them.
And so they were able to take it home.
Did our military, I'm assuming, find them?
Yes.
And take them home? How long of a process was that?
I think it wasn't horribly long. I'm trying to remember. I think it was about 2 weeks, maybe 2 weeks by the time they found them.
Okay.
So they were dropping rations, and then they were asking them to take rocks or sheets and write PW in as large as they could out on any area where they might be able to see them. And so that is by far, I think for me, that was the hardest part of the book to write, believe it or not, was when he was recovered. Because I couldn't imagine, I just couldn't imagine what that must have felt like after almost 4 years of the brutality that he had, to be able to know there was an American voice coming through a jungle to come get him. And so that was... That part of that rescue is in that book is the hardest part for me. Every time I read it, I still cry.
Yeah. Because you think about that being in survival mode.
Yes.
And then when you're finally able to have to think about, oh my gosh, this, and then it all is coming. I mean, that's just.
Everything.
Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was an amazing story. I want to tell you about my grandmother. I just want to tell you what my grandmother did. We talked about, you know, prayer and faith and, you know, whatever. My grandmother was a warrior. I mean, she was a prayer warrior. And as soon as they found out, because he was missing in action, they didn't know where they were for a while. I'm not sure how long that length of time was, but it was maybe 3 months or 4 months. She had no idea where he was. Mm-hmm. And once they found out, she found out he was a POW, she started what she calls the Walls of Jericho. And she had an oak tree in her backyard, and she marched that oak tree, circled that oak tree and prayed the walls of Jericho to drop it. And she stayed and prayed and prayed and prayed day and night. And they finally, she dropped in the yard one time, and she got ladies from her church, and they started coming in, and they started praying. Mm-hmm. And they started marching the walls of Jericho for him. And so I'm convinced beyond anything in the world that my father got home because of the prayers that were carried on the backs of these people.
I can't imagine being a mom and for 4 years.
I know. I know. Can you imagine seeing him for the first time?
No.
Yeah.
No. He looked like a totally different person.
Totally different.
But oh, the joy.
Yes.
Of having him back.
Absolutely.
Gosh.
Yeah. He came back. He was 6 foot one, about 220 pounds. He came back 6 foot, lost an inch in height, and he lost about 45% of his body weight. And so can you imagine seeing your son?
No.
But she was so grateful.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So when he came home, he didn't get out of the military.
No. He reenlisted.
Which that's amazing.
I know. My dad was the absolute strongest patriot you would have ever met in your life. He said, I did not hesitate one minute. He said, and if you ask my father, and children always wanted to talk to my dad whenever we took him somewhere. You ask my dad, like, how did you do it? What would happen now? And he'd tell you flat out every time, I'm going to tell you right now, I would do it all over again to keep the American flag flying in this country one more day.
That's amazing.
One more day. That's how he was.
Yep.
And so he signed up, and he served in the military for 31 years. He was in the Air Force and was a mess hall cook. And we spent a lot of our Thanksgivings with the soldiers because it was he had to feed them on Thanksgiving and Christmas. And so we spent a lot of our Thanksgivings there. And
y'all were overseas.
We were in San Antonio at Lackland Air Force Base the majority of his career.
Okay.
The majority of his career. We got stationed one time in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Oh, sad.
I know. You know, it's such a sacrifice to have to go there. But interesting, Hickam Air Force Base, which is right where the Pearl Harbor bombing is where he served.
Wow.
And so he served in the mess hall there. And we were in Hawaii. I grew up on those beaches.
That's amazing.
For 4 years. It was wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. And I want to show y'all the picture.
Oh.
How old is he here?
He's 97 in that picture.
I know. I'm so sad y'all can't see. We're going to have to make sure somehow we let y'all. But just the cutest little thing.
He's a doll. That's
oh my
a doll.
Gosh. And y'all, when I look at these two pictures.
Yes.
Exact same jawline.
Absolutely.
Same, like we said, the same lips, the same.
Yeah.
Just so amazing.
Yeah.
What he went through.
Yeah.
In his life.
Yeah.
And one thing I want you to get to share, because I know it's important to you, and I love it, and that's why I wanted you on here, is you were so purposeful in writing this book. And the other thing that I think is really cool with this book is you love to give it to veterans.
Yes.
And you go and you speak about this and
yes.
you share his story lots of different places. If you're interested, we'll give you the information. Because you have a heart for veterans.
Yes, I do.
That have gone through similar or maybe even not, but have gone through it without Jesus.
Yes.
And you so want them to know that God sees them and he knows them and that Jesus can save them.
Yes.
We know, you mentioned this, and we know this is true. So many of our veterans come back and take their own lives.
Yes, they do.
And September, you know, we know here is Suicide Prevention Month.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's so important for us, for our veterans.
Yes.
The statistics are heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
And so you were so purposeful with this to have them in mind.
Yes.
When you wrote this. Talk a little bit about why you did that and kind of how it goes in the book.
Well, I felt like, you know, his story needed to be told irregardless, but the fact that it's a faith-based story, at the very end of this book, it literally leads you to the gospel, and it is the prayer of going through and walking through, and it's in his vernacular and his speaking of, you know, if I could go through this, you know, and trust on God and get through this, then you can. And here's how you do this. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple prayer. And so that is what I think separates this book from a lot of POW stories or whatever, is that this book was intended and led by God to ensure that if you got to the end of this, you are going to hear the gospel story. And my heart is very, very heavy for our veterans. I never walk anywhere. I walk anywhere. If you've got a hat on, you're a veteran, I'm going to go over there to you, shake your hand and say hello. And if I have a conversation, have a book with me, I'm going to hand it to you.
Right.
So I just take donations. I raise money just to give these books away. Mm-hmm. And I've given away probably 300 books over time. And it's given me an opportunity to meet veterans and give them hope and tell them we love them and we appreciate their sacrifice and what they did. And so that's what I've been doing since I wrote the book.
Yeah. So the thing I love about this book and your dad is that he walked with hope the entire time.
Yes.
And it's just beautiful that, one, I love that you got his story.
Thank you.
I love that he shared it with you.
Yeah.
And I think you said this in the beginning, I think it is very true. So many come back and don't talk about it.
No, they don't.
And they don't share.
Right.
And as this generation is getting older and passing away, we're going to lose this part of history. Yeah. And I love so much that he was willing to share.
Yeah.
And you were willing to...
secretly write
get it
notes.
Down. Yeah. And so you were able to do that. And I do think it's so cool. And I didn't know this. You just told us the third Friday in September, which is just this last Friday.
No, this coming Friday, tomorrow. Right.
Yes. So, but this will release next week. So,
oh, oops, you might want to scratch that.
No, you're good. Sorry. Listen, when we record early, it makes us have to use brain power. So tell me what it is, because I'd never even heard of this before.
Okay. So have you seen the POW MIA flag? It's a very large black flag, and it has a silhouette of a soldier. I don't actually know when the beginning of national recognition for POW MIA began, but it began as a result of the fact that we had so many all over the world. And MIAs, you know, you don't even know. You don't even have a message on them.
Yes.
And so that's why they're
just missing.
Correct. They're missing.
And we don't know.
And we have no idea. And many, many of the military were missing in World War II and still are. They still don't know. Mm-hmm. So they did a remembrance day, the third Friday of September. And to ensure that we never forget the sacrifice of a POW and a soldier or a mom or a dad that doesn't know if their son's going to come home.
Yeah. I love so much that whoever in our country decided that we needed to have a day of remembrance. I love that. I am very much one of those people. I need things to remind me.
Mm-hmm.
We are forgetful people.
We are.
And to have those things in place to make us go, oh yeah, we need to remember that.
Right.
We need to stop and remember that.
We do.
And I love that they have that day.
I do too.
And I'm so glad now that we all know that they do have that day.
Yes.
And you brought me a sweet little
pin
to wear for
I
that.
Did.
And so thank you so much. This, y'all, where can people get the book?
Well, if they want to just get a copy, they can get it off of Amazon.
Okay, great.
It's on Amazon.
Okay.
My publisher is Zulon Press, which is a Christian publishing company out of Florida. But I usually purchase with these donations large amounts of copies so they can always directly
reach out to
with me.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay. And we're going to put her email address on here so you can see that if you want to directly reach out to her for either to get a copy, if you would like her to come speak at something, any of that, you'll be able to reach out to her. You always can reach out to me here at the church, and I can connect you as well. But if you want to grab a book, Amazon, publisher, that kind of stuff, it is definitely one that you tear through. It's not an easy read in the sense of it will make you feel.
It will make you feel.
But in the best of ways.
It will in the best of ways.
Just the best of ways. I highly encourage, especially if you have military people in your life, if you are so incredibly thankful. I love that your dad said that we have the flag.
Absolutely.
That we have the freedoms that we have, that we take so for granted.
We do.
If you want to be reminded of how precious those are.
Yeah.
This is a great book to remind you of that. And also, just like we said, one of those stories that if we don't purpose to tell it and remember it, our kids and our grandkids aren't going to remember. They're not going to know.
That's correct.
That this happened.
They're not.
And we so want this to be something that gets told.
We do.
We really do. Tina, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
You're just a joy. I told you in the beginning, she's just a joy. And so we're going to have you back on another time. We'll talk about something else.
Okay.
But I'm so, thank you so much for coming and just sharing your dad and your life. And we'll do another one and just do miracles, because she shared like four before we started.
Yes.
I was like, we just need to come back and talk about miracles, which are so
fun
and just amazing to see how the Lord does things.
Oh, it is.
And when you go, this is the Lord.
That's correct.
This is him.
I didn't write this book alone.
No. And just his hand upon your life. And the fact that you are willing to be his hands.
Oh.
And tell your dad's, tell the Lord's story.
Yes.
To people.
Yes.
And just, I appreciate you so much. So thank you for coming and hanging out today.
Oh, thank you.
Y'all, if you see Tina in the hallways or over at Helping Hands, tell her thank you for coming and sharing with us today. And we will see you next time on Table Talk.